see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
It may not always seem that way, but it is a wonderful world, a world of possibilities. I'm Mary Muckle.
And I'm Elena Banta. During this hour, we share information on a variety of topics such as science and technology, finance, nutrition, health, entertainment, excuse me, the arts, and current events. Today, we'll talk about what it feels like for kids going back to school. And we'll tell you about some famous people who attended various Chicago high schools and what really happens when we vent online. We'll tell you about why a four-day school week improves math skills and some ways to tell if people are lying. We'll also talk about new developments in the art and science of transplantation. We'll share poetry and short stories by William Butler Yeats, Edgar Guest, Michael McPhee, and others. And we'll have another episode of Mary's World. And last, but certainly not least, we'll have some jokes and a variety of silliness to leave you laughing. Also, at the end of the show, we'll give you a telephone number to call so that you can give us some feedback. Sound good? Stay tuned.
September brings kids back to school, but sometimes parents are unaware of problems their children might be having. Here is an article in Family Time magazine, the 2015 issue, and it's called Back to School Butterflies, Helping Your Child Calm the Jitters by Ashley Talmadge. Colin was starting sixth grade in a new school. At an orientation event, he became clearly unnerved as he struggled with a combination on a sticky locker. His concern, says Mom Lynn Brown, was whether he'd be able to open his locker during school when they only had 4 minutes between classes. Colin's particular fear is surprisingly common, and so is his apprehension about the beginning of a new school year. Most kids, even excited ones, experience a few butterflies in the first weeks, and the source of such uneasiness is not always obvious to parents. What kids worry about? Age, experience, and temperament all determine a child's concern. Young children with little experience outside the home may exhibit separation anxiety. Being in the care of adults other than their parents can be an initially stressful for some children, notes Deb Cockerton, a child and youth behavior counselor. These youngsters also worry about practical matters, such as finding the bathroom and getting on the right bus. When they're a bit older, children worry about whether they'll have friends in their class and where they'll sit at lunch. Older teenage students are concerned about how they will fit in with their peers and how they will do academically, says Cockerton. The start of puberty and issues like cyberbullying, body image, and athletic ability may be additional stressors. Some worries are not obvious to parents, Carrie Norris, principal and longtime educator, says. There are always some things we don't think about as adults. We've had the little ones who are afraid to flush the toilet in the loud echo chambers. Older kids who are beginning to measure themselves against peers may feel humiliated if they wear the wrong clothes or they come to school with a nerdy haircut. Major transitions can cause feelings of insecurity, even if a child has previously done well. Brown says that Colin was extremely successful and a model student during the elementary years. Yet as a kid who thrives on routine and predictability, it took time for Colin to adjust to the new academic expectations, the more complicated schedule, and the preteen social dynamics of his new school. Signs of anxiety. Kids express anxiety in many ways. Some are more vocal and quite specific about the concerns. But more often it is a child's behavior that indicates his distress, Cockerton says. The younger child can become more clinging, not wanting to leave mom's side. The tummy ache is a common symptom of stress in younger kids. Older children can suffer physical symptoms such as headaches. They may eat more or less than usual when they're feeling anxious. And Norris notes that they may also experience sleep interruptions and moodiness. How parents can help. Kids feel more confident and competent when they come to school prepared. Experts like Cockerton and Norris agree that parents play a leading role in helping kids cope with back-to-school fears. Here are 15 ways to calm the jitters. Talk to your child about what worries her. Provide accurate information if she is misinformed. Listen carefully and respond empathetically. Avoid saying, "Don't worry, you'll be fine." Focus on your child's very real concerns. Create safe space. The tween who resists face-to-face conversation may open up at an unexpected moment. Look for natural opportunities to listen and check in during daily activities, riding in the car, doing a chore, playing a game. Read books, Cockerton says. Books can give kids language to express what they are feeling. School challenge characters can also normalize a child's feelings. List it. Help kids refocus on the positive by listing the things they're excited about, as well as the things that scare them. Meet and greet. Make introductions to teachers and school personnel. Brainstorm. Help your child build a repertoire of possible solutions to a problem. Brown's son, Colin, was anxious at the thought of changing into his gym clothes amongst the other boys, she says. We helped him figure out where he could change and feel that he had some privacy. Play what if. What would you do if you got your lunch? What would you do if you couldn't find your homework? This technique gets even the youngest kids involved in problem solving. As Principal Norris says, developing the skills to solve problems independently lasts a lifetime. Role play. Act out potentially uncomfortable interactions. What can you say if you want to be friends with someone? What can you do if someone is mean to you? Resist overscheduling. Keep extracurricular activities manageable, especially during the first months of school. Kids need downtime to unwind and reflect. Show confidence. Let your child know you trust her ability to succeed. Remind her of her many challenges as she's faced and managed in the past. Check parental fears, as Cockerton says. Children are very good at reading their parents' emotions, and if the parent is worried about how their child will do at school, the child will interpret this as something to be worried about. Make home comfortable. Kids who are worried about a parent's physical or mental health may be reluctant to leave home. When major life events, divorce, death, a family move occur, maintain as consistent a routine as possible. Get help if your child's difficulties persist, Brown says. Networking with the school personnel is a critical piece of the puzzle. Open communication with school teachers, counselors, and others is paramount to ensuring the most successful year possible.
That's good advice.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, thank you. Moving on. Feelings of anger are part of the human condition, and we all need to learn how to deal with those feelings without taking them out on someone else. This is an article from the August 21st, 2015 issue of The Week magazine. It was taken from the Wall Street Journal and was written by Elizabeth Bernstein. The article is entitled, "The Danger of Venting Online." "Don't hit send," said Elizabeth Bernstein. "The digital revolution has empowered all of us to vent our spleen through angry emails, tweeted put-downs, furious texts, and sarcastic Facebook posts. But scientific research has repeatedly found that venting is bad for us. People temporarily feel better after e-venting, but scientists have found it actually leaves them angrier and more aggressive. In real life, face-to-face feedback usually tempers what we say when we're angry because we can see we're dealing with another human being with feelings. Online, there is no natural restraint on impulses, and there's something about expressing rage in the safe isolation of a tweet or a text that leads to more extreme language. Writing something down means you've committed yourself to the expressed feelings, and rereading your rant and an equally furious response can make you even madder. And remember, a rant put out via the internet is a click away from being shared and shared. Researchers on internet rage recommend you delay any response to any online provocation and take deep breaths or a walk. Quote, "A bad vent could come back to hurt you."
Oh, boy.
Yep.
Well, Here are a few brief histories of some of our Chicago high schools. Perhaps you've had friends or relatives that went to them, like I did. Sullivan High School. Sullivan is a four-year public high school located in the Rogers Park neighborhood on the north side of Chicago. It is the home of the Tigers. History. Sullivan opened in 1923. The school is named for businessman and Illinois politician Roger Charles Sullivan. Sullivan opened as a junior high under the Chicago Board of Education's plan creation of junior high schools in Chicago. The school began serving as a traditional high school when junior high schools were phased out in 1933. Notable alumni are Ira Burkow, New York Times sports writer and author, Hal Bruno, Newsweek correspondent and director of ABC News, Sidney Blumenthal, journalist and aide to Bill Clinton, Shecky Green, comedian and actor, Dick Marks, jazz pianist, Charles Percy, U.S. Senator, Jan Schakowsky, U.S. Representative in the 9th Congressional District from 1999 to the present. Okay, Carl Schurz High School. Schurz is a public four-year high school located in the Old Irving Park section on the northwest side of Chicago. The school is named after German-American Carl Schurz, a statesman, soldier, and advocate of democracy in Germany. The school building, which represents a combination of the Chicago and Prairie School of Architecture, was designed in 1910 by Dwight H. Perkins and designated a Chicago landmark on December 7, 1979. It is considered one of the 150 great places in Illinois by the American Institute of Architects. History. The land where the school was built was purchased in 1908 with an estimated construction cost of $500,000. Notable alumni are Sybil Bauer, swimmer who set 23 world records in her career. She won the first ever Olympic gold medal contested in the world's backstroke. Ray Colone, alderman of the 35th Ward of Chicago. Bruce Dalmont, host of the political radio and show Beyond the Beltway. And he also founded the Museum of Broadcast Communications. And that's it for Schurz. And Robert Lindblom High School is known as Robert Lindblom Academy of Math and Science. It is located in the West Englewood neighborhood in Chicago. The school, constructed in 1999, is named for Robert Lindblom, a 19th-century Swedish-born trader on the Chicago Board of Trade. Later in the 20th century, it developed curricula to prepare students for college. In 2003, the school was modernized with new computers and labs. Lindblom is one of the 10 selective enrollment schools in Chicago and offers only honors and advanced placement courses. Notable alumni are Cheryl Burton, TV journalist on WLS-TV, Lance Crothers, star and writer of The Chris Rock Show, Mickey Johnson, Chicago Bulls player, and Gene Rayburn, radio and TV host show of The Match Game.
Wow, there's some illustrious names coming from Chicago high schools.
Yeah, some we kind of forgot about.
Mm-hmm. Okay, moving on. Transplantation surgery has come a long way, as you will see in this article from the August 14, 2015 issue of The Week magazine. This is an article entitled, A Child Receives Two New Hands. An 8-year-old Maryland boy has become the world's first pediatric bilateral hand transplant recipient, reports CBSNews.com. Zion Harvey lost his hands and feet to gangrene 6 years ago. The same infection also forced him to undergo a kidney transplant. And since he was already taking anti-rejection medications for the new kidney, Harvey became an ideal candidate for a bilateral hand transplant. A 40-person team at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia performed the groundbreaking 10-hour operation, working simultaneously to connect the old and new bones with steel plates and screws before using microvascular techniques to link up arteries and veins. Once blood began flowing through those vessels, surgeons painstakingly repaired and reattached muscles, tendons, and nerves. Harvey has already used his new hands to eat, though they'll remain numb for a while. The nerves have to grow back from his own native nerves into the transplanted hands, says Dr. Benjamin Chang, co-director of the hospital's hand transplant team. It's going to be 6 months before he gains feeling. Doctors expect his new hands to grow along with the boy, who looks forward to swinging on monkey bars and throwing a football. Never give up on your dreams, Harvey said. It's good advice from a little kid.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Okay, and moving on. The question has been raised many times. Could three-day weekends help school districts cut costs without undermining student learning? A new study suggests it's possible. This is an article from Mental Floss Online on September 1st, 2015, suggesting that it works, especially for math. Researchers from Georgia State University and Montana State University found that elementary school students who spent an extra day out of the classroom had higher test scores in math than those with standard academic schedules. Published in the journal Education, Finance, and Policy, the study compared the academic performance of children who attended traditional five-day schools with kids who had four-day school weeks, using fourth-grade reading and fifth-grade math test scores from the Colorado Student Assessment Program. Researchers found that the four-day week did not affect reading outcomes, but that it did have a statistically significant impact on mathematics. This finding contradicted expectations, remarked Mary Beth Walker, dean of the Andrew Young School of Policy Studies at Georgia State. Like other educators, she questioned whether students would forget classroom material during a longer weekend, or if the longer school days required for a shorter school week would overwhelm kids' short attention spans. Four-day weeks help school districts lower overhead and transportation expenses and are common in rural parts of New Mexico and Wyoming. In Colorado, over one-third of the school districts run on a four-day schedule. Other states across the country, including Oregon, Missouri, and Florida, have considered following suit. However, until this study, there were only anecdotal reports on how the system impacted students' learning, researchers say. Further studies are needed to understand the effects of a four-day school week on larger urban school districts, as well as to draw additional conclusions about why a shorter week seems to bolster student performance. Walker thinks the extra day off might have enhanced teachers' happiness, increased productivity, and lowered absentee rates. But at the end of the day, there is little evidence that switching to a four-day week harms student performance, researchers write. Policymakers and school administrators will want to take these findings into consideration when weighing the costs and benefits associated with the four-day school week. Okay, moving on. There's always something interesting going on in your world, Mary. What have you got for us today?
Okay, my high school reunion is coming up, and I'm looking forward to it. I went to Evanston High School in the suburbs and enjoyed every minute of it. I was in musicians' club, Spanish club, German club, and I played intramural basketball every week. Obviously, I wasn't home very much. We had kids from every walk of life there, and we all got along. But like all normal people, we all had our trials along the way. Here is an incident that I had there. My high school announced that they were going to have a turnabout dance. I decided I would like to ask this guy, Bill, to the dance. So I wrote a note asking him to it, but our paths never crossed that day, so I asked my friend Liz to give Bill the note. From then on, Liz stopped speaking to me. I couldn't figure out why. Then I find out that she was going to ask Bill to the dance, and that's why she wasn't speaking to me. If I had known that, I would have asked someone else. 25 years later, at another high school reunion, our first one, she still wasn't speaking to me. I told my girlfriend Sandy about that, and she said, that's a long time to hold a grudge. I wonder if I ran into her again somewhere, she'd still be holding that same grudge. Oh, well, that's just the way things go sometimes.
That is a long time to hold a grudge.
Yeah, I'll say. Okay, and I have for you today some two poems by William Butler Yeats, and we'll have a little bit about him in a minute. Okay, here we are. William Butler Yeats was an Irish poet and one of the foremost figures of the 20th century literature. In his later years, he served as an Irish senator for two terms. He was born June 13, 1865, and died January 28, 1939. He had an interest in Irish legends, the occult, and astrology. The two poems I'm reading today are from Yeats are Anne Gregory and Two Songs of a Fool. Okay. Anne Gregory. Never shall a young man thrown into despair by those great honey-colored ramparts at your ear love you for yourself alone and not your yellow hair. But I can get a hair dye in such color there, brown or black or carrot, that young man in despair may love me for myself alone and not my yellow hair. I heard an old religious man but yesternight declare that he had found a text to prove that only God, my dear, could love you for yourself alone and not your yellow hair. That was kind of funny. Two Songs of a Fool. A speckled cat and a tame hare eat at my hearthstone and sleep there. Both look up to me alone for learning and defense, as I look up to Providence. I start out of my sleep to think someday I might forget their food and drink, or the house door left unshut. The hare may run until it's found, the horn's sweet note and the tooth of the hound. I bear a burden that might well try, that men do all by rule, and what can I, that a wandering witted fool, but pray to God that he ease my great responsibilities. I slept on my three-legged stool by the fire. The speckled cat slept on my knee. We never thought to inquire where the brown hare might be. And whether the door was shut, who knows how she drank the wind stretched up on two legs from the mat, before she had settled her mind to drum with her heel and to leap. Had I but awakened from a sleep and called her name, she had heard, it may be, and not had stirred. That now, it may be, has found the horn's sweet note and the tooth of the hound.
Thank you. I have a poem called It's September, and it was written by Edgar Guest. He was born in 1881 in England, and he came to the U.S. when he was 2 years old. He died in 1959. His sentimental, optimistic poems were widely read for 40 years throughout North America, which prompted the ultimate cynic of the 20th century New York literary scene, Dorothy Parker, to write, "I'd rather flunk my Wasserman test than read a poem by Edgar Guest." That's a little harsh.
Mm-hmm.
But here he is. It's September and the orchards are afire with red and gold, and the nights with dew are heavy and the mornings sharp with cold. Now the garden's at its gayest, with the salvia blazing red and the good old-fashioned asters laughing at us from their bed. Once again, in shoes and stockings are the children's little feet, excuse me, and the dog now does his snoozing on the bright side of the street. It's September, and the cornstalks are as high as they will go, and the red cheeks of the apples everywhere begin to show. Now the supper's scarcely over ere the darkness settles down, and the moon looms big and yellow at the edges of the town. Oh, it's good to see the children when their little prayers are said, duck beneath the patchwork covers when they tumble into bed. It's September, and a calmness and a sweetness seem to fall over everything that's living, just as though it hears the call of old winter trudging slowly with his pack of ice and snow. In the distance over yonder, and it somehow seems as though every tiny little blossom wants to look its very best, when the frost shall bite its petals and it droops away to rest. It's September. It's the fullness and the ripeness of the year. All the work of earth is finished, or the final tasks are near. But there is no doleful wailing, every living thing that grows, for the end that is approaching wears the finest garb it knows. And I pray that I may proudly hold my head up high and smile when I come to my September in the golden afterwhile.
Beautiful poems. Mm-hmm. I have two poems by Michael McPhee. And Michael McPhee was a poet and essayist from Asheville, North Carolina. He was born in 1954 in Asheville and educated at the University at North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where he is now a professor of English in the creative writing department. Much of his works deal with the native North Carolina mountains. He's written several books of poetry and several essays. And I have two poems here. One is called Spitwads, and the other one is called The Answering Machine. I'll read Spitwads first. Little paper cuds were made by ripping the corners or edges from homework and class notes. Then ruminating them into balls, we'd flick our fingertips or catapult with pencils, or sometimes after lunch, launch through striped straws like deadly projectiles toward the necks of enemies and any other target where they'd stick with the tiniest splot. I hope you're still there, stuck to unreachable ceilings like the beginnings of nests by generations of wasps, too ignorant to finish them, or under desktops with blunt stalactites of chewing gum, with little white words we learn to shape and hold in our mouths while waiting to let them fly, our most pernicious utterance. my dad was guilty of spitballs I found out later in high school.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Okay, and this is The Answering Machine. Mother, she always hated it, would hang up in disgust or start talking before I stopped talking, the shadow of her twang lingering like smoke before the beep. So I play back this old cassette, hoping for a scrap of her voice. Some syllables I can splice to her legacy of snapshots. It's a kind of a soundtrack to a kind of movie, a film strip life that signals between frames. But it's been too many years. She's been erased by spoken postcards, junk mail, dates and times. I'll never need again blank static stretches as the real tape reels in its slick magnetic tongue. Father, he hated it too, but had plenty of time to wait and try to swallow the quavery widow's voice that lodged in his throat right after she died. But nothing helped. He always sounded morose. Even the most casual messages verged on tears. Something about this unanswering machine made his loneliness worse. It was like talking to God in the dark, him taping every sad prayer, or talking to her all the unresponsive day. Others, it's like listening to your high school yearbook. So many friends and others say, keep in touch. I even hear my out-of-town self say, how peculiar. Oh, I guess some answering machine drives some people nuts, I guess.
It does. It sure does. Okay, I have a poem called In September by Amy Leiby. She was a British writer born in 1861 and died at the age of 27 in 1889. The sky is silver gray, the long, slow waves caress the shore. On such a day as this, I have been glad, who shall be glad no more. Yeah, she was, I think, a little depressed. And the next one is just called September, and it's by Lucy Maud Montgomery. And she was a Canadian writer, born in 1897 and died in 1942. And she writes, lo, a ripe sheaf of many golden days gleaned by the year in autumn's harvest ways, with here and there, blood-tinted as an ember, some crimson poppy of a late delight, atoning in its splendor for the flight of summer blooms and joys. This is September.
Beautiful. I like that. It's really beautiful. Mm-hmm. Okay, I have a story from the Tales from India, and it's called Indigo Jackal, and it was translated from a man called J.E.B., those are the initials, Gray. And it's translated from Sanskrit and Pali, the classical languages of the Brahmins and the Buddhists. Okay. the indigo jackal. A certain jackal who lived in a forest fell into an indigo tub as he was wandering about on the outskirts of a town. As he was unable to get out, he thereupon pretended to be dead and remained like this till morning. When the owner of the indigo tub saw him, he thought he was dead, and so, lifting him out, he carried him some distance away and threw him down. The jackal ran off and entered the forest, and then, finding that he was all blue, he began to think to himself, "I am now the very best of colors. Why should I not do something now to advance my position as life?" After considering the matter, he summoned all the jackals together and addressed them. "I have been anointed by the holy goddess of the forest. By your own hand I have been anointed with an essence of all the plants in the woods. Look at my color. From this very day onward, therefore, everything that goes on in the forest must come under my command." The jackal saw that he was indeed a distinguished color, and so, bowing low with their ear to the ground, they said, "As your majesty commands, so it will be." In this way, then, the jackal gradually gained sovereignty over all the other animals dwelling in the forest. He surrounded himself with a retinue of lions, tigers, and the like, and as a result, he began to look upon his own kin, the other jackals, with embarrassment. He therefore contemptuously banished them. All the jackals were in despair, but one old jackal reassured him. "Do not be despondent," he said, "for though we have been treated with contempt by this fellow who does not know how to behave, we do know his weak points. I shall arrange something to bring about his downfall. Since these tigers and others are deceived by his mere color and do not recognize him to be a jackal, they naturally accept him as a king. You must therefore act in such a way that he betrays himself. So follow this plan which I shall describe to you. At evening time, you must all raise a great howl in the vicinity where he is. When he hears that sound, he will be bound to be giving an answer and yell of his account of his very nature as a jackal. Indeed, people say, one's own true nature is a very difficult thing to shake off. If a dog were made a king and were hungry, would he not gnaw a shoe?" The jackals accordingly carried out the plan, and surely enough, when the indigo jackal heard the great howl, through the twilight he began to give tongue himself. Immediately one of the tigers recognized him for what he was and promptly killed him. Such is the fate of a fool who deserts his own side and joins the enemy. Oh, boy.
Uh-huh.
Too boastful. Too boastful there.
Okay. Yep.
And
okay. Moving on. This is not a story about the month of September, but it was written in September 2011. The writer is known only as J-A-E-K. He has a blog on which he posts his work, but not his name. In 2011, he challenged himself to write one original short story each day during the month of September. The story I'll be reading is entitled Fierce Loyalty. As long as I'm sitting here, I may as well tell you how it happened. Before you judge me, it would be best if you just try and put yourself in my shoes for a minute. I couldn't explain what led me to do what I did, even if I tried. Don't make any sense, really. Everyone has a point where they break. Friends can become enemies as quickly as enemies can become friends. Good times can turn bad in an instant. Here and there, like sunlight through roiling storm clouds, reason will shine down like a spotlight. I guess I just chose not to heed reason that day. Jeremy and I had been camping up there on Stoneface Ridge just about every year since we were about 12 or so. Kids back then didn't mind being outdoors or spending more than one or two nights without their parents in the next room. Likewise, we knew how to do stuff like build campfires, pitch a tent, or even set a snare to catch a rabbit or two to skin and eat later. Most years, we staged our camping trip over Labor Day weekend, even when we got older and we didn't think like kids anymore, though we sometimes still acted that way. Nobody knew where we went because we never told anybody. Only Jeremy and I knew about the low-laying saddle between the western ridge lines up on Stoneface. Pretty much every camping trip was the same every year, that is, until this last year. Quite suddenly, I realized this was to be our last trip ever. Really, there was no other choice. See, Jeremy had brought his girlfriend up to Old Stone Face Ridge without so much as even considering the sanctity of an annual trip that had always belonged to just the two of us. This was an unforgivable breach of the very bond of brotherhood that we had sealed with a blood oath some 15 years before around that very same campfire. Under the circumstances, I'm sure you would have reacted in the same manner, more out of instinct than any sort of premeditated scheme. Violence was never something I was very fond of, and I'm still not comfortable with the raw physical act of brutality that took possession of me at my very core. Women scream at just about anything, and Jeremy's girlfriend was no exception, screaming from the time I grabbed her and tossed her over the eastern edge of the ridge all the way to the bottom, where her screams just stopped. Xenophobia is what my therapist called it, an irrational fear of foreigners and strangers. You know, I think it's more than that, though. Zealous loyalty, that's what I'd call it. Wow, that's taking loyalty a little too far.
Yeah, really extreme. Okay, and I have a story called Old Man at the Bridge, written by Ernest Hemingway. And Hemingway was born July 21st, 1899. He died July 2nd in 1961. He was an American author and journalist, and he was raised in Oak Park. His most famous books were The Old Man and the Sea and For Whom the Bell Tolls. Today I am reading the short story, The Old Man at the Bridge. An old man with steel-rimmed spectacles and very dusty clothes sat by the side of the road. There was a pontoon bridge across the river, and carts and trucks and men and women were crossing it. The mule-drawn carts staggered up the steep bank from the bridge with soldiers helping push against the spokes of the wheels. The trucks ground up and away, heading out of it all, and the peasants plodded along the ankle-deep dust. But the old man sat there without moving. He was too tired to go any farther. It was my business across the bridge, explore the bridgehead beyond, and to find out to what point the enemy had advanced. I did this and returned over the bridge. There were not so many carts now and very few people on foot, but the old man was still there. "Where do you come from?" I asked him. "From San Carlos," he said, and smiled. That was his native town, so it gave him pleasure to mention it, and he smiled. "I was taking care of animals," he explained. "Oh," I said, not quite understanding. "Yes," he said, "I stayed, you see, taking care of animals. I was the last one to leave the town of San Carlos." He did not look like a shepherd or a herdsman, and I looked at his black, dusty clothes and his gray, dusty face and his steel-rimmed spectacles and said, "What animals were they?" "Various animals," he said, and shook his head. "I had to leave them. I was watching the bridge in the African-looking county of the Ebro Delta and wondering how long it would be before we would see the enemy, and listening all the while for the first noises that would signal that ever mysterious event called contact." And the old man still sat there. "What animals were there?" I asked. "There were three animals altogether," he explained. "There were two goats and a cat, and there were four pairs of pigeons." "And you had to leave them?" I asked. "Yes, because of the artillery. The captain told me to go because of the artillery." "And you have no family?" I asked, watching the far end of the bridge, where a few last carts were hurrying down the slope of the bank. "No," he said, "only the animals I stated. The cat, of course, will be all right. A cat can look out for itself. But I cannot think of what will happen of the others." "What politics have you?" I asked. "I am without politics," he said. "I am 76 years old. I have come 12 kilometers now, and I think I can go no further." "This is not a good place to stop," I said. "If you can make it, there are trucks up the road where it forks to Tortusa." "I will wait a while," he said, "and then I will go. Where do the trucks go?" "Toward Barcelona," I told him. "I know no one in that direction," he said, "but thank you very much." Thank you very much again. He looked at me very blankly and tiredly and then said, having to share his worry with someone, "The cat will be all right, I am sure. There is no need to be unquiet about the cat. But the others, now what do you think about the others?" "Well, they'll probably come through it all right," I said. "Do you think so?" "Why not?" I said, watching the far bank where now there were no carts. "But what will they do under the artillery when I was told to leave because of the artillery?" "Did you leave the dove cage unlocked?" I asked. "Yes, then they'll fly." "Yes, certainly they'll fly, but the others?" "It's better not to think about the others," he said. "If you were arrested, I would go," I urged. "Get up and try to walk now." "Thank you," he said, and got to his feet, swayed side to side, and then sat down backwards in the dust. "I was taking care of animals," he duly said, "but no longer to me. I was only taking care of animals." There was nothing to do about him. It was Easter Sunday, and the fascists were advancing toward the Elbe. It was a gray, overcast day with a low ceiling, so their planes were not up. That and the fact that cats know how to look after themselves was all the good luck the old man would ever have.
Wow.
Poor little old man.
Yeah, he saw some action, I think.
Yeah, probably.
Okay. Our comedy segment this week is brought to you by
Tick-Toe-Tock. Do you have a small bedroom? Are you unable to put your alarm clock next to your bed because of it? And a table wouldn't fit? Is your dresser so far away you can't put it there either because you won't hear it? Get Tick-Toe-Tock. Tick-Toe-Tock is a small alarm clock on an elastic bracelet that attaches to your big toe. Just set the time and then slide it over your big toe. And the next day, Tick-Toe-Tock will ring, and you will be surely able to get up in the morning. Tick-Toe-Tock is available at nosuchthing.com.
And by AntFlow's fans. AntFlow has developed a new model of fan that will revolutionize the problems of dealing with hot weather. It's called RoboFan. It's a robotic fan that hones in on your body heat and follows you from room to room. Yes, my friends, no more high electric bills from running the air conditioner day and night. No more tripping over extension cords connected to old-fashioned fans in every room. No more worrying that you forgot to turn the fan off when you left the house. When you're not there, RoboFan turns itself off. And best of all, RoboFan accepts voice commands. You can tell it things like, "Stop right there, you're getting too close." Or, "I have a headache and I'm in a really rotten mood today. Could you be a little quieter?" And unlike your children, RoboFan pays attention. So, when the weather heats up, be cool and think of RoboFan.
Wow, that sounds good.
Okay, moving on a little bit. Milton Berle was one of our best-known and best-loved comedians. His career spanned six decades, from vaudeville to television, and he had jokes about every conceivable subject. Here's Uncle Milty on the topic of kids in school.
A teacher told her friend, "I have one child in class who's impossible. He's loud and nasty, he talks all the time, and the worst thing of it all, he's got a perfect attendance record."
Little Billy brought home his report card. His mother took him to task for all the low grades. Little Billy responded, "Well, it's got its good side, too. You know darn well I'm not cheating."
Miss Brown was very upset with Jimmy, saying, "This composition about the puppy is exactly like your brother's." Jimmy said, "Why not? It's the same puppy."
Little Jimmy brought his report card back to school and told his teacher, "Look, I don't want to scare you, but the next time I bring home a report card that bad, somebody's going to get whipped."
The teacher says, "If any of you have to go to the bathroom, please raise two fingers." From the back, little Johnny says, "How's that going to stop it?"
Oh, okay. And little Joey complained about school. I'm not going back tomorrow. I can't read yet, I can't write, and they won't let me talk.
The teacher asked the class where God lived. Many ventured different opinions. Finally, it was little Peter's turn. He said, "The Lord lives in my bathroom." The teacher said, "How could you say a thing like that?" Little Peter said, "It's true. In the morning, my father gets up, knocks on the bathroom door, and says, 'Good God, are you still in there?'"
The kids in my old neighborhood never drop out of school. There'd be nobody to drive the teachers crazy.
The teacher reproached the student. "You can't sleep in my class." The student said, "If you didn't talk so loud, I could."
He went to school one day a year. That was to find out when vacation started.
My son was out of school for 3 days last week. His teacher sent home a thank you note.
I had a terrible time in school. Everybody hated me because I was so popular.
Our local high school just figured out a way to save money. They're going to teach driver, ed, and sex education in the same car.
This school teacher got married, but she couldn't forget her training. Every time her husband sent her a love letter, she sent it back corrected.
My nephew thinks school is stifling. They teach you to spell a word only one way.
The teacher asked the class to write a composition on where the elephant was found. One kid wrote, "The elephant is so big, he's hardly ever lost."
The teacher checked Johnny's math and shook her head. Johnny said, "But I added it up 10 times. You can see my 10 answers if you want to."
Mixed emotions is when your kid gets an A in sex education.
Yeah. The human brain is special. It starts working as soon as you get up, and it doesn't stop until you get to school.
My son always complained that he'd never learned to spell in school. The teacher kept changing the words.
A second grader is heard saying a terrible four-letter word by his teacher. She admonishes him, "You shouldn't use a word like that. You don't even know what it means." The second grader says, "Sure I do. It means that the car won't start."
A school custodian can tell how far the semester has progressed by the size of the crayons on the floor.
A youngster comes home from school with a note from the teacher that says he doesn't have an inquiring mind. The mother is furious. "You're going to have an inquiring mind. I'm going to make you have an inquiring mind. If I have to beat you, you'll have an inquiring mind." The youngster says, "What's an inquiring mind?" The mother says, "Shut up and don't ask so many questions."
It costs more nowadays to amuse a kid than it used to cost to educate his father.
Oh, gosh. "Did Mary's lamb follow her to school every day?" a young boy asked his father. "That she did," his father said. "How did it all end?" the inquisitive boy asked. "They finally separated," the father said. "The lamb graduated."
A school kid asks his teacher, "Is it true that the law of gravity keeps us on Earth?" And the teacher says, "Yes." And the kid says, "What kept us before the law was passed?"
A student is reprimanded for not having written a book report on Dickens' novel. The student says, "I couldn't help it. We couldn't get the video."
I must be missing something. Parents drive kids to school, and then the kids go to a physical education class where they learn how to exercise.
My kid must have a Chinese teacher. She's always giving him homework to take out.
I once fell in love with my public school teacher. It didn't work out. She was 24, I was 38. Okay, well, as if that wasn't bad enough. This is the moment you've all been waiting for, or possibly dreading. It's time for what we think are the world's worst jokes.
Queen Elizabeth was a fat woman. She strongly resisted the demands of the Spanish ambassador.
Oh, these are gems collected by a sixth grade teacher from exam papers over several years. So, let's see. And on one of them, we get, "Strategy is when you don't let the enemy know that you're out of ammunition, but you keep firing."
Twilight sleep means you set your clock 3 hours early.
A virgin forest is a forest where the hand of man has never set foot.
The general direction of the Alps is straight up.
A city purifies its water supply by filtering the water, then forcing through an aviator.
Most of the houses in France are made of plaster of Paris.
The people who followed the Lord were called the 12 opossums.
Oh, no. The spinal column is a long bunch of bones. The head sits on top, and you sit on the bottom.
We do not raise silkworms in the United States because we get ours from rayon. He's a larger animal and gives more milk.
One of the main causes of dust is janitors.
Animal husbandry is to have more than one husband.
A scout obeys all to whom obedience is due and respects all duly constipated employees.
One byproduct of raising cattle is calves.
Napoleon wanted an heir to the throne, but since Josephine was a baroness, she could not bear children.
To prevent head colds, use an agonizer to spray into the nose until it drips into the throat.
Oh. The four seasons are salt, pepper, mustard, and vinegar.
The climate is hottest next to the Creator.
Oliver Cromwell had a large red nose, but under it were deeply religious feelings.
The word trousers is an uncommon noun because it's singular at the top and plural at the bottom.
Sin tax is all the money collected at the church from sinners.
Manhattan Island was bought from the Indians for $24, and I do not suppose you could buy it now for $500.
Henry VIII, by his own efforts, increased the population of England by 40,000.
The Civil War was started by Lincoln signing the Emasculation Proclamation.
The blood circulates through the body by flowing down one leg and up the other.
Well, looks like that's all we have time for. I'm Elena Banta.
And I'm Mary Muckle, coming to you from Chris Radio, your information station. Our producer has been Brian Hawkins. Tune in next week when we'll be back with new information, more fiction, and new jokes. We'd love to hear from you. Any writers or poets out there? Send us your best stuff and we'll read it on the show. Stories should be no longer than 10 minutes. And remember, keep it clean. Send all material to Brian Hawkins, Chris Radio, the Chicago Lighthouse, 1850 West Roosevelt Road, Chicago, Illinois, 60608. If you have feedback for us, please call Brian at 312-997-3687 or TTY 312-666-8874. We'd like to leave you with something to think about. In the great words of the great comedian Phyllis Diller, housework can't kill you, but why take the chance? This has been a world of possibilities. Thank you for listening.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them blue for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white. The bright, blessed day, the dark, sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? They're really saying, I love you. I hear babies cry. I watch them grow. They're like much more than I ever knew. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Yeah. I think to myself, what a wonderful world.